This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. To round out our hour about the influence of the cassette tape on culture and politics, we head over to Iran.
I was born in Tehran in 1955.
Mohsen Sazegara. He was a precocious kid, bookworm, loved reading about political theory and political philosophy.
I don't know, maybe you call it geek or something. I tried very hard during all my education years.
He left Iran, moved to Chicago in the mid-70s to study physics. But by 1978, his focus was very much back home.
Making a revolution.
At that time, Iran had already been engulfed in a years-long struggle against the country's tyrannical leader.
Iran, inshallah, ke dar moqabil khariji.
The Shah.
Shah came to power with a British and American plot, and he was a military dictator.
He and his secret police, Savak, ran the country with an iron fist and impunity.
The, you know, shadow of Savak was everywhere.
And Mohsen and all sorts of other folks wanted this guy out. I mean, there were nationalists fighting against the Shah, Marxists and leftists like Mohsen. And, well, they'd made some strides getting people out onto the street to protest, things were stagnating.
Yes, without that, we have a long battle.
And so, Mohsen and his smarty-pants leftist allies decided to hit reset, which is where our story really begins here.
We went to a small village about half an hour, 45 minutes out of Paris.
This town, Neuf-le-Château, would be their new base of operations. They knew someone there who owned this rudimentary house they could stay in.
I remember there was one shower which had no hot water in the cold weather of France.
And they were bunking up with this relatively unknown and very unlikely ally, this long-bearded cleric, the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Khomeini was quite old. He'd been in exile for quite some time.
That's Kim Khatas.
Longtime journalist who's covered the Middle East and the United States.
She says Mohsen's allies had handpicked Khomeini to join them.
We needed a religious leader that was activist against the Shah.
Someone who could really inspire people to take to the streets. And Khomeini fit that bill.
Yes, he was very adamant. He was kind of crazy. He was the kind of guy who would not compromise. He said the Shah should get the hell out of Iran.
This is Iranian writer and activist Arash Azizi.
You know, he said, Mehmed Reza bayad bere. It means Shah has to go.
And so, you know, Mohsen and the other leftists.
Because all of us were well-educated in best universities of Western countries.
Thought they could use Khomeini, overthrow the Shah, and then cast Khomeini aside.
Yeah.
And so, from this tiny town, these strange bedfellows hatched a plan to make Khomeini a superstar.
This small village, 20 miles to the south of Paris, has become the center of resistance to the Shah of Iran.
Mohsen and the leftists, with their connections,
they've set up literally a media office.
Made a bunch of calls, sent out tons of press releases.
You're able to call for peace.
And before long,
his title is Ayatollah.
Neuf-le-Château became the center of the media universe.
Good evening from Pontchartrain, France.
And with the cameras trained on him,
tonight, the 78-year-old Muslim religious leader, Ruhollah Khomeini.
Khomeini became the voice of the revolution. Sort of. Because, and this is where things get a little complicated, sitting on the floor or out under an apple tree, Khomeini would let the reporter ask their questions.
If the peaceful demonstrations do not succeed, will you then order your followers to fight?
And he then answered those questions in Farsi, which the reporters didn't speak. So, the leftists like Mohsen,
we would like to continue the way as it is as much as possible.
Would step in to translate. And what they said, what they translated, something soft, smart, and diplomatic.
The cause that we are striking is the independence of the country and the liberty of our own people.
Was often quite different from what Khomeini had actually just said.
Khomeini believed in what he called wilayat al-faqih. Let me just check how I translate that. Mm-hmm. A state, a wilaya of the faqih, of the wise man. So, you know, an Islamic state on earth.
Yeah. He thought that if you implement a religious order from Middle Ages, everything will be right and we will have a utopia on the earth.
And so it was like, was that a red flag for you in any ways?
No. You know why? Because we were in danger by Secret Service of Shah, Savak. We were imprisoned by Shah and we were ready to sacrifice our life. So our first priority was to bring down regime of Shah. And we thought that Khomeini was in our side.
And again, they also thought Khomeini was a useful puppet they'd eventually discard. They were the ones in control. And so anytime he brought up this idea of the Islamic State,
they would omit that, as they called it, crazy talk. So that part of the message did not reach the Western media.
But the problem was that basically no part of the message was reaching the people of Iran.
How are your orders communicated to the millions of your followers in Iran?
The Shah of Iran, he had an iron grip on media, and media would have been the radio and TV and the newspapers.
Again, Arash Azizi, who says the Shah had this media blockade that was effectively preventing all of this news coverage, all of this messaging, from making it back into Iran to its target audience.
And there was not, of course, any WhatsApp or any internet services.
So they needed to find some underground analog way in. Enter the cassette tape.
Every week at weekends, after evening praying,
oftentimes sitting in this blue and white striped tent that they'd erected in the backyard.
Ayatollah Khomeini, he had his speech about sometimes an hour or less than an hour.
And this is where they'd let Khomeini be Khomeini.
And we recorded them to cassette tapes.
Shah, you are not a king. You are a nasty, rebellious person. You are ruling the country against the rule of law. People want a politician, a ruler whose beliefs are based on Islam. Islam is the religion that half a century ago conquered all countries in the region to make them decent human beings. Islam is not dictatorship. It is God's rule. And when Khomeini had finished his speech and the recording was done,
after his speech, I took that cassette to the basement,
recorded a little intro onto it.
The speech of the great leader, then the date.
And one day, Mohsen, or one of his allies, thought, maybe there's a way to send these cassettes, these speeches, back to Iran.
Maybe by telephone. In that house, we had an international line, and a colleague in Iran, who was an engineer in telecom of Iran. And he and his friends, they could open international line, one international line, from Iran for us, like a collect call.
And while these speeches were less diplomatic, less polished than the messages Mohsen had been passing to the Western press,
they didn't mind whether the Iranians who were religious heard this message about an Islamic state. because they thought, okay, it would bring them out onto the street, and it's never going to happen anyway. So let him say whatever he wants, because it's all crazy talk.
I remember the first time,
after one of Khomeini's weekend speeches,
I took the cassette upstairs to our colleagues, and I remember that they smoked cigarettes very much, and their room was always covered by smoke. Gave it to them, and then our friend in telecom connected the line, and
with the revolutionaries in France, now speaking to the revolutionaries in Iran, they attached this tape player to the phone and pressed play.
And our colleagues in Iran,
using a little tape player on their end,
recorded it.
And when the call was finished, the folks in Iran, they took the tape out, rewound it, played it back.
You can just imagine the crackly quality that you would get.
And it worked. Suddenly, Khomeini was there with them in that room. With their proof of concept, they started going wild with this.
Yeah, yeah.
Once a week from France, they'd set up a conference call.
So there could be many phones calling at the same time.
All the folks on the call would record it.
Answering machines were being used.
From the various points in Iran, then they'd start making calls, spreading it further. And along each step of the way,
this network of people,
you know, have almost a little cottage industry duplicating the tapes.
They duplicated it thousands.
And thousands and thousands of times.
It becomes a flood.
So, yes, it's estimated that it took about 9 hours from a speech being given by Khomeini to it being spread in large numbers of tapes in Iran.
I mean, these things were spreading hand to hand, from family member to friend, in the bazaar, in living rooms. I mean, at its peak, some 90,000 mosques were duplicating and distributing these tapes. Well, it feels to me like this is Khomeini seeing how to create virality before virality was a word outside of epidemiology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Khomeini knew exactly what it meant. The art of Khomeini was he exactly knew what to say to go viral.
What to say, and just as importantly, how to say it.
Great politicians in the world, most of them can speak very well and have very good lectures. But Ayatollah Khomeini was not like that. His grammar is one of the worst. Maybe I gave him a D or F.
He used the verbs in the wrong way. He had quite a provincial accent.
This is Nazila Fati,
former New York Times correspondent based in Tehran for 17 years.
She also grew up in Iran as all this was happening, and she says his language was so strange that educated folks made fun of him.
One of the jokes was that yogurt is white. Yogurt is white. Three words. Because all his sentences were like that. Very simple and obvious things.
But while the upper crust was mocking him,
his speech was more attractive for ordinary people.
He was from rural Iran, and so were many, many Iranians, millions of Iranians. Even the ones who had grown up in the cities, their parents came from villages. And so this was a very familiar language to them, similar to the language of their fathers or grandfathers.
And on top of all this was the way they were hearing it.
People had cassette players at home, so you could listen to it at home and you could sort of gather around
and all together listen to those cassettes.
And when they did that, when they sat down and pressed play, it's not a politician speaking to a reporter. It's not a politician behind a lectern giving a stump speech. It's not even some image being beamed into your television and your neighbor's television and their neighbor's television. It's a man in your living room speaking to you and saying that there's important work to be done and that you're invited to be a part of it. That you've been treated unfairly, that you've been wronged, but that with your help, we can fix it. We can make the world a better place. We can make the world as great as it used to be. And that the only thing standing in our way is one man.
So his voice gave them an identity, purpose. This voice that they could keep hearing, and it would drill in over and over and over again.
One Iranian man we spoke to who heard these tapes said, in hindsight, that it was almost like Khomeini had hypnotized him. And he was not unique.
Everybody in Iran, in every faction, listened to Ayatollah.
Millions of people. I mean, when Khomeini called for strikes on these tapes, they happened. When he told people to take to the streets on these tapes, it happened. And when he told the Shah to get the hell out of Iran, that eventually happened as well.
The man who from long distance had led the revolution to topple the Shah.
The people were in a frenzy.
It was through these cassette tapes that Khomeini mobilized the masses and managed to hijack the revolution from all the other political parties.
January 16th, 1979, the Shah fled Iran. And what he would be replaced by, what Khomeini's victory actually meant for Iran, began to come into focus just 2 weeks later, as Khomeini was flying from France back to Iran.
When they were on their way back to Tehran on the Air France plane that had been chartered for them.
Again, journalist Kim Khatas.
As the plane entered the Iranian airspace, Peter Jennings of ABC, of course, managed to get up to Khomeini and ask a question.
Sadek, would you change the rest?
And he asked him,
would you be so kind as to tell us how you feel about being back in Iran?
And the Ayatollah listens to the translation of the question into Persian, and the answer is hichi, nothing.
And the translator, as always, one of these leftist intellectual types,
he just can't believe what he just heard. So he asks the Ayatollah, hichi? And Khomeini repeats, and I'm reading sort of phonetically, hichi ehasasi nadaram. I don't feel a thing.
Now, what he meant by nothing, none of us will ever know for sure. But listening to that interaction, and this is something that Kim Khatas felt too, you do get the clear sense of a man who sees himself as simply taking his next predestined step into power. A man who sees himself as apart from and above the trifling emotions of politics and men.
Here is a man who's been in exile for 15 years, and he's about to touch down in his home country, and he feels nothing?
And his translator almost didn't seem to know what to do with those words.
He tells Peter Jennings...
Doesn't make any comment.
He doesn't make any comment.
Is he happy or is he excited?
Doesn't make any comment. Don't answer the question.
None at all. Okay, thank you.
Okay, all right.
Thanks, Doctor.
That moment on the plane is when you start seeing the danger of what Khomeini actually represents. But it was too late. I think it was too late.
Mounting tension between the US and Iran.
304 killed in recent protests.
And to this day, the Islamic government is ruling Iran.
Iran has launched a series of ballistic missiles targeting
the debate over whether women should wear a hijab.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals.
It shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane.
The Iranian government responded with a five-day internet shutdown.
I guess I wonder, Mohsen, your voice on these tapes, how do you feel knowing that your voice is in some ways forever intimately tied to Khomeini's voice?
Not so guilty, I have to say.
Okay.
Because now that I look back, we know that the combining revolutionary ideology with religion is a wrong way. But in those days, nobody knew that. Not only me as a 23-year-old student, but none of the thinkers, even the Western thinkers. So I was a part of a big movement in Iran by the people of Iran.
You didn't know how dangerous this thing was that you were pushing on people.
Yeah.
But you're doing it. Have you had to grapple with that fact?
I can say that, unfortunately, I didn't think about the future. The system that he suggests, we thought that we can make an utopia on the earth. We were wrong. I can't say now that all those thoughts were wrong.
Mixtape was reported, produced, and scored by Simon Adler, with reporting and production assistance provided by Eli Cohen. A lot of other people contributed to the making of the series, whose names you'll hear when you go to listen to the other episodes at radiolab.org. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.